Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, David Griscom. Hello, David.
Hey, brother. How are you?
I'm doing well, and we're pleased to be joined again by Deep State Kuba himself from This Is Revolution. Kuba, hello.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. Now, I saw
are
you
at... Counts nice and high? You know, have you been getting enough red lights on your nether regions?
I've been freezing my balls, but we'll get into that later. You know, it's just different hypotheses in bro science. And, you know, that's the scientific method. I actually thought of you for this. We did with Brandon Sutton, another Tucker Carlson original on Blake Masters, the candidate. And since I had my free trial for Fox Nation, I figured I'd illegally record some of their other content. And I thought of you for this one. This is, I think, the first one Tucker released called The End of Men. And I saw, I think, a thread you posted on Twitter, and I think you guys have been covering some of this at TIR, like the kind of conversation we've been having in this sort of group for a while, even when Michael was here, about like, okay, like Jordan Peterson and all these guys, the model for young men they have is bullshit and it is ridiculous and laughable. But there actually is like a huge problem here that it's being exploited by the right. If there's anything generally you want to say on this topic, go for it, Kuba.
Yeah, the it's a sore point that there's on TIR, Pascal actually is one of the main kind of like theorists about the crisis of masculinity. And it started out by looking at the specific kind of African-American manosphere. But the overlap between that and the Jordan Peterson, Tucker Carlson, bro science world of male influencers and masculinity gurus is so clear that this is a broad phenomenon. And there's two parts to it, because we're only seeing the reaction to a real need and a great deal of pain among young American men, especially, but it goes all the way into adulthood, where there's a reckoning with diminished life expectations, possibilities for material advancement, for social recognition, and that's happening to everybody, but men feel it men feel it differently, because it goes hand in hand with the readjustment of gender roles in a more egalitarian direction that forecloses some of the old timey advantages that men expected to enjoy as they grew up and came of age. And that leaves a lot of people adrift, where you have a breakdown of mentorship. There aren't the same institutions that, sports teams, Boy Scouts, martial arts clubs, even within academia, right? The professors are a lot more cautious about the way they interact with younger students. And quite frankly, if you look at the DEI evaluation criteria, you get a lot more points for mentoring a minority woman than you do for helping what's seen as another privileged white man, especially, climb up the ranks. So this has created this pain that's felt keenly by millions of men across the United States, felt indirectly by the victims of some of those men that turn bad and externalize that pressure through violence, misogyny, abuse, sometimes going all the way up to spree shootings. The right has pounced on this in order to set itself up as the the voice of reason, the people who care about you, the ones that will tell you the secret and hidden truth of all nature, that will reveal your destiny as a man to you and help you along that path. And the grotesque thing about it is, if you look at somebody like Jordan Peterson, there's some perfectly sane, sensible advice on how to be more effective, how to try to get ahead personally, how to have more agency and discipline in your life. But that's all wrapped up in toxic politics and an exploitative business plan, mm-hmm. where you're pumping money out of the same people that you're promising to help. Tucker Carlson.
I just wanted to note, too, I think that one thing that's interesting about that whole like cottage industry is that, because I think the mentorship, like the loss of that, I think is like a big factor. And that's just like a loss of like general sociability, I think, in like American society, or, you know, more broadly Western society, if you want to expand it. But what's interesting about it is, like, here's like the solution that's being presented to you. And at the end of the day, it still is like a very isolated activity, right? It's like, you got to read the Peterson book. You got to watch the Tucker Carlson documentary by yourself. You're still isolated and probably alienated from your neighbors and your community. But you feel that, like, oh, I have this like shining light path that can maybe bring me out of it. And it's one of those things that, you know, it's typical with cults and stuff too. It's like, you know, if you're not getting the results that you want, it's because you're not, you know, going hard enough. You're not cleaning your room enough, or hating women enough, or whatever.
Discipline.
Yeah, successes always get credited to the great leader, and failures are always your own personal weakness. And there's one other thing that we should touch on, which is sex. And the part of what's driving the male alienation is inability to find a girlfriend. The very term incel comes from involuntary celibacy, right? The unavailability, inaccessibility of sex. And we've had, over the last two generations, a very radical reshaping of cultural attitudes towards sex, of the way in which people meet, the way in which you can impress a potential partner, the way that you connect. On the one hand, all kinds of queer sexualities, which had previously been marginal and subcultural, are just flourishing out in the open now. And there's been also, through internet pornography and the dating apps, the things like OnlyFans that sort of bridge the two, you have a commodification of sex, and it creates bizarre expectations on the part of men about what you can get, what's out there, while also stunting the development of relationships. The practices, right, the courts, where the rituals where you actually meet somebody and you get to know them. Instead, apps try to gamify dating, and it also becomes a grist for people's social media experiments and self-promotion. So I can't think of how many times one social media platform or another has suggested to me a video or a post about, I mean, look at this asshole trying to pick up girls online. Like, oh, can you believe all this cringy, these cringy reactions that a woman's profile gets from would-be suitors. Also, everybody knows about dick pics, and every woman at some point has had to deal with the unsolicited erotic spam that some men compulsively produce. And this makes it's, I'm not saying that it's fine to harass people or to overreact if you're rejected online. Quite the contrary, right? You should be able to take that anyway. But that culture of humiliation when somebody does go too far is especially difficult for young men, because that's when you're making mistakes. Right. That's when you can't really control your emotions. You haven't had experience dealing with rejection. You feel it the most keenly, your own sense of who you are, where your value comes from, is the most fragile and vulnerable. And without mentorship and without trial and error experience, they also don't have the skills to be charming. And if you're not a natural LA 10 with a whole bunch of money and Hassanabi's abs, then you have to learn those social skills. You have to learn how to use your words, and that takes time. You're going to make mistakes. If those get translated into online humiliation, then it's another impetus that drives young men into that kind of desperation, which makes them easy pickups for the likes of Tucker Carlson, Jordan Peterson, and all that ilk. And in the thread, what I suggested was, as an alternative, I didn't find a leftist, but Doug Stanhope, the comedian, he has a great bit where he talks about ISIS, but you could just sub in the alt-right and Tucker Carlson, that they look for disaffected young people, mm-hmm. especially men, online to recruit to their political efforts. His point was like, that's my demographic. I'm working this block. Get off. And that's... he makes the point that, like, if you're honest, if you can relate to the misery that a lot of young men are going through, if you tell them honestly what they can expect, then you can build bridges and you can create an audience. While an audience and relationships is not what Tucker Carlson or Jordan Peterson are looking for, they at best want a market, and at worst they want foot soldiers for their political projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's really evident in, you know, our feature film of the day, where you get some descriptions of some very troubling dynamics in sort of environment, relayed by some narrators of differing reliability, and then a sharp right turn into some very bizarre solutions to that. But I also want to just say, like, my personal experience, I've never been like a super ladies man, but fairly confident. But I will say, like, the years between grad school there's 2 years between me having employment were the toughest time for me dating. And I didn't even really, to be honest, I didn't date a whole lot during that time. I was still in the apps, but like, when you have to go on a date, and in New York particularly, a conversation is, well, what do you do? And it's like, well, I'm looking mm-hmm. for work. And it's tough. And mm-hmm. like, I think that is a huge, I understand people like going through that particular meeting of economics and, socializing with others. Mm-hmm.
And if you think and it's two-sided, right? Like, since everyone is going through this difficult period of diminished opportunity, and financial struggles are extremely common among young people, a potential partner that you're dating, they have their own mess to deal with. And if what you're bringing to the table is another mess, then it's very tempting to just swipe left and hope that the next guy has a job. And especially early on a first date, what do they owe you, right? You can't really blame them for trying to find somebody that might make their problems easier yeah. rather than somebody that you can expect will lean on you more and more. And yeah, I mean, my experience, like my 20s, early 20s especially, were were pretty bad. But then, I mean, it helps if you, it helps, like you said, it helps if you've got a job. It helps you if you have some disposable income.
You can go on vacations, right?
You can go on vacations. You can pay for dinner. And it all of the experience that you have can then help you help them. So as you overcome your own problems, you become a more desirable partner, but that takes time. And especially if you get, tempted down these right-wing rabbit holes, that's a real risk, because instead of working on your own problems and building yourself up as a person, as a man that can be helpful, that can offer support, that can offer emotional reassurance too, tell people that, you know, things are going to be okay. This is what you got to do. Tomorrow's another day. Then instead you're just like making money for, the bro scientists. You're chilling supplements online. You're, you know, working out at overpriced gyms, and you're wondering why the pieces don't add up to the better life that you expected.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good point to embark on our endeavor here. Let's start with right away with the way he intros this. And you'll notice it starts with a warning. What does it say here? The program contains toxic masculinity, high levels of testosterone, bro science, and testicle tanning, which may be triggering to some viewers. Discretion is advised.
I want to see the lab results for the high levels of testosterone, because I'm not buying it.
I welcome this opportunity.
But just to summarize, what we're going to see is JFK hates fat kids. Basically, that's a big part of the historical message of this film.
Speak to the people of America about a subject which I believe to be most important, and that is the subject of physical fitness.
You want to say something, Cuba?
I like the idea that you had all these fat kids in the States, and there was like an epidemic of cannibalistic witches, Hansel and Gretel style, right? Like, no, we have to have trim children that can find their way out of a gingerbread house.
A country is as strong, really, as its citizens. And I think that mental and physical health go hand in hand.
There is nothing, more unfortunate than to
We're
have
Trump there.
Soft, chubby, fat-looking children. I hope that all of you will join, and everybody in the United States, to make sure that our children participate fully in a vigorous and adventurous life, which is possible for them in this very rich country of ours.
Yeah, I should say, I'm actually going to probably need to upload this on Patreon, because there's a lot of footage that Tucker will cut to here that's really disturbing, that they wouldn't show on like Fox News, of like, you know, a guy wrecked, or that, like, it's very Jose Not a J on YouTube has done a series on all of these Tucker Carlson originals, and like, it's a very emotionally manipulative thing that Tucker does for these.
There's been a 50% decline in sperm counts in the last 40 years, along with a precipitous decline in testosterone production. We're headed for a calamity, and that's not hyperbole, it's not exaggeration, it's just a mathematical fact.
Now, that is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and he's good. A guy who, one of the reasons they play the Kennedy clips is to bolster his credentials. They don't want to go into his work on anti-vax and the autism link. They don't mention that at all. And he's a guy who, it's funny, like, to see Tucker Carlson, the irony of him covering these sort of like environmental chemicals things. RFK has been on Majority Report talking about those exact same things at like Mass Torts Conference in Las Vegas, of like trialers suing DuPont and stuff, for instance, about these chemicals. That work is all important. And the solution is like not, as we get into like tanning your balls, but like the EPA. let me just play a little bit more of that.
Would you recommend young men to tan their balls?
To what?
Here we get a little bit preview of Riot Nashville.
Once a society collapses, then you're in hard times. Well, hard iron sharpens iron, as they say, and those hard times inevitably produce men who are tough, men who are resourceful, men who are strong enough to survive. And then they go on to reestablish order, and so the cycle begins again.
So yeah, that's the intro.
Do you know where that thing is from? That quote, yeah, because that's a big right wing one these days.
Well, it's there's this I forget who does this painting, but there's this famous painting that shows like civilization waxing and waning. It's like four or five different paintings, and all these guys. I think that is just Rag Nationalist. Maybe it's from like I don't know Marcus Tullius Cicero or something like that, but I'm not sure beyond that.
The quote itself. Apparently is from just some novel that came out relatively recently. And it because it gets overlaid on those classical paintings, it has this aura of ancient wisdom. But it's like 5 years old. And it's, you know, from some like hard sci-fi quasi-fascist, right, like self-published sci-fi novel. But and that's one of the hallmarks of this kind of masculine revival rightist rhetoric, that they always hearken back to ancient wisdom or with Matt Walsh and his stuff, it's all about nature. They're looking for some source, but they're also the people who know the least history and have the least appreciation for science, can't possibly think in nuance. It's the equivalent of imagining the entire ancient world that you understand it because you watched 300 once.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting, and like I'll save more stuff for once we get into some of these examples here, but one thing that I think is interesting about the embrace of this stuff by like the Tucker Carlsons is like this stuff has always sort of been around. Like, you know, I grew up in like the kind of hippie community, and it's one has been fascinating to see how many of them just became like big Trumpers. But when you think about it, it's like, okay, distrust of science, distrust of medicine, distrust of like big things, and an idea that the government's been basically poisoning us and putting stuff in our water to take away like our humanity. It's not surprising to see how those people went right, but it has been interesting to see the right wing sort of embrace. Like, what I'm saying is that like growing up in the 90s, I saw all this kind of shit, but with people who consider
the wellness shit.
Yeah, you know, to be outside of politics, right? And you might sort of read that as left wing, but under more investigation, you realize it's not really too left wing as much as it is like countercultural. But what's interesting is like today, so much of that stuff is explicitly right wing. And I think the difference is that like there, they might sort of try to hearken to like ancient Greek or ancient Roman wisdom, when before it was like, oh, this is a Buddhist or Hindu know, practice or something like that. So maybe the one defining factor is like who the sources of wisdom's nonsensical and made up sources of wisdom are. But yeah, I'm excited to learn some more techniques.
Well, he dives.
Yeah, that's the classic beta stuff.
But yeah, exactly. That's some low T energy right there.
Very low T energy. I mean, you can't sustain 10 minutes.
Yeah. Keep it up, man.
So he dives right into some more, ancient wisdom. And we get anacyclosis, I think is what it is.
Civilization is like a woman wooed. She's won by the love of the strong man and lost by the impotence of the weak one. The Greeks called this anacyclosis, the life cycle of any society. In a golden age, heroic leaders pursued transcendent goals, something bigger than themselves. They overcome challenge after challenge, and then they win. Then, surrounded by the wealth and the comfort they have won, they lose their life force. They become confused and isolated. They lose faith in themselves, and the civilization they've created begins to decline.
I'll just say for the listeners, he shows pictures of Biden looking sort of confused about how to exit a podium. And it's funny. Yeah, go ahead.
Of course he's going to pick anacyclosis because it's the like Greek, therefore white-coated cyclical variant.
As you know, is the funniest thing about that is the project of turning the Greeks into white people was a very purposeful project in like the 19th century. Because for most of the time, you know, they're Asiatic, right? They're outside of the scope of Europe.
Yeah, like the ancient Greeks would get that like pass, but the modern Greeks are like, yeah. And the Greeks themselves, if you read some of the early, I think Aristotle himself, maybe, he's talking about the Greek complexion. And he's like, we're the best because we're not dark like the Asians or the Egyptians, but we're also not pale like the Scythians or the northern barbarians. And so his whole thing is we're not white because the white people are the ones running around on the steppe or in the forests, hitting each other with sticks, frightened of the sun. Yeah.
You want to be moderate in your pigmentation.
Yeah, exactly. It's moderation in all things, including pigmentation. There's a Ibn Khaldun, the great Arab historian, he had a version of anacyclosis around the rise and fall of dynasties in the Middle East. And he chalked it up to asabiyya, which means kind of tribal solidarity. And if you think about it, it's actually the left-wing variant of this, rather than having to do with individual excellence, right? Like hard men. It has to do with the spirit of unity that can link together a tribe into a cohesive fighting force and then allow one of the leader of the tribe to exercise authority without violence or tyranny because of that mutual respect and fellow feeling. That over time erodes. And in his cycle, it's the erosion of social solidarity that actually brings about the end of one dynasty and the opening for another group to come in from the desert, which still has that tribal unity, that solidarity, and making them a more formidable force. But no, you gotta break it down to the individual level if it's on the right, because it's all about the excellence of white manhood. As though somehow if only we had like a Schwarzenegger or, I was going to say The Rock, but he went a little too far in the pigmentation department. So maybe Jason Statham as our dictator king, then everything would be fine.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say Ibn Khaldun. He sounds a little soy, but anyway.
You know, I don't want to like expire all of my talking points too early, but like the thing too about like fitness and stuff, I don't think it's arguable right now that professional sports in the United States are at their highest level they've ever been. When you look at like the physical capacities and like the abilities of these players versus like what these strong, watch like a football game from like 1970s, like, yeah, some of the tackles aren't allowed anymore, right? But like it is very low quality compared to even a college game today. Yeah. You know, so this idea that like if you were to measure society on this level, the idea of like the people who we consider to be like the strongest of the strong in our society are way stronger, way faster, way more skilled than they've ever been in human history. And that's, again, you know, sorry for being too much of a Marxist. It's like I'm a believer in, you know, concepts like progress. And like you see that like there's been tremendous, you know, improvements in our ability to, as like athletes and things like that. But
also incredible inequality, because access to those improvements requires capital and it requires time. And
so Messi, who just, I think that's a good point too, but you know, Messi, who just brought his team through the penalty kicks against the Netherlands, when he was really young, he was super teeny. like a tiny guy. He had like a lot of skill, but they were like, oh, this guy's not going to grow very, you know, very much more. And, you know, any kind of dreams of being a professional soccer player sort of kaput. The father somehow raised something like $1 million to give him experimental growth hormone treatment. Which first of all, like I always do think about that, because if someone told you like, oh, my son's going to be the best player ever and I'm going to do this, you'd be like, hey man, save your money. Don't like ruin your life over this. But in this one specific case, he was absolutely, you know,
oh yeah,
and we're doing it, but
investment,
but you're right. There is no separating the fact that, you know, you have to have access to a lot of, you know, these systems to be successful. Like, it's a problem with like U.S. soccer right now is that it's mainly rich kids, but I don't want to get too far in the weeds of talking like sports stuff, but it is just funny to see that we're at a different level than we used to be there.
There's something very interesting there. I had a conversation with a friend of mine. He's German, so of course, totally into soccer. And we were talking about the different training regimens that soccer teams would put players through over time and how they changed. And at the beginning, like especially if you go to the mid-century, they're practically amateurs, right? Like you run drills, like you know, under 14 girls team, right? Like run to that post and back, and then we'll have some scrimmages, and then we'll practice kicking. It's like starting in the 60s and 70s, you've got like this Ivan Drago model where, and that's also where steroids come out of, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're going to have a kind of Fordism of fitness. We'll pump you up with the right drugs and vitamins, and we'll have this very mechanized approach, and we're just going to have an assembly line of supermen, one after another. And now we're in kind of the bespoke, hyper-individualized human growth hormone, if you're small, nutritional interventions tailored to your specific diet, to the position you play. And it brings the cost up, but that tailoring also gets you those insane results where contemporary athletes are just, head and shoulders, sometimes literally, above players from previous generations.
Yeah. And I mean, I think this might be in the clip we'll get to, but if it's not, he mentions like the rise in obesity rate. And it is true, like since 1990, I think the statistic was like there was one state that was above the obesity rate, and that was Mississippi. And now it's basically every state. And that is clearly a response, like our food system, right? Like, and maybe environmental factors like microplastics that he hints at there. And like, so the idea that it's like some sort of laziness or we're letting kids out of gym class too early, like it's completely beside the point. We'll continue a little bit more with anacyclosis.
Warned of a West that one day would be filled with what he called men without chests. And we see that prophecy coming true today. We call them less poetically man boobs. They're a physical manifestation of something bigger. The decline of manhood, of virility, of physical health. All of which together threaten to doom our civilization. Testosterone levels in American men are declining by about 10% per decade. 1% a year. Sperm counts have plummeted 50% in the last 40 years. If that trend continues, we won't.
That's always a big sort of assumption in these sorts of things. Now, I'm not an expert on the sperm rate thing, but my sense is that, yes, there is a very real and somewhat concerning drop in sperm counts. Whether it's a civilizational, what is that movie with Clive Owen in, or it's something that can be addressed. But I mean, to be like, it's very clearly like if there's something like that, it's results of like DuPont chemical and things like that, putting microplastics into the environment.
Weaker than
go ahead.
Also think about the montage, the images that he's putting together. He's talking about declining sperm counts and obesity. If you flip back, there's, a brief shot of a male model putting on makeup.
Yeah.
That guy's thin. That guy's probably jacked.
Yeah.
Isn't he doing it right? But it's because this is also coded as homophobic, right? Like the whole point is that these are heterosexual, virile, manly men. And clearly somebody who might be queer would have to fall outside that spectrum of desirability, even if they actually lived up to those, to the physical standard that Tucker Carlson was putting. Right? This is very exclusive. This is very clearly targeted primarily for white men.
Right. Matt, tell me if this is a good time to talk about Teddy Roosevelt very briefly.
Yeah, go for it.
I don't know if he comes up again, because like he is like the myth maker of like the manly man.
The strangest life.
You know, and that guy was like number one fancy boy of all time. Like that was a guy who went on adventures and brought like Ovid with him, you know, to go in when he was cosplaying as a cowboy. You know, it's been amazing to see the mythology around him coming back, because like, look, I will say like Teddy Roosevelt, absolutely, you know, horrible, disgusting American imperialist president. It is true that he did go out and do a lot of interesting things, right? But in the same way that if you're like a rich guy who can go and like go on adventure, and these are like, you know, these are experiences that are curated versus like a guy who's sort of living an exceptional historical life. This is a wealthy guy who can go like, I'm going to go to Arizona and just like fuck around there for like 3-4 weeks and see what happens, see if I get myself into any trouble.
I'm going to hunt big game in Africa, and I'm hiring a small army of guides and porters and assistants because, you know, I'm not unrolling my own sleeping bag.
Yeah, look, I don't want to be too much of the Teddy Roosevelt apologist here. I got the Badlands in my background there. It is true that when he was in the Dakotas, he did confront a guy who said he was going to murder him. He said, you're going to what now? And the guy backed down. So like as an individual, a decent amount of courage. But like you say, David, it's we know about it because he was a New York fancy boy.
Yeah, exactly. In politics. I'm just saying like, amazing stories of dudes in that period of time. Like, I don't know. And it was one of those things that was curated for his presidential campaigns. And now like people come back and it's like, oh, the history of like the greatest manly man in American history. It's like, no, like the story that was being presented so that people trusted him to be, you know, president at that time. But it's also funny. This is the thing that's so funny is like, I mean, because we're talking about two things here, right? We're talking about what this right-wing movement is trying to do and what they represent. But like, feeling like there's a crisis in masculinity is not something that's actually particularly unique to this period of time in history.
Oh, no.
Like, that's like the get-go. Yeah. And the same thing with like feeling like America is becoming less American. We had Matt Chrisman on the show. We were talking about, you know, Tipper Canoe and Tyler too. And like, they had this is like the early 1800s. America had barely been a country, you know, for less than a century at that point. And there was already this feeling that we had lost our kind of pioneering spirit. So they really, you know, amped up, you know, the draw on the accent and like we're front porch cider sipping guys. When again, they were also fancy boys as well. But like, we've always had this anxieties and they're not unique to America. This is like across all cultures that the youth are weak and they're not going to be able to, you know, take us to the next level. And they're preying on this kind of universal experience. And I'm not saying that there's no questions to talk about health or anything like that in our society. But this is like something that like, this is something you can sort of plug in to a lot of moments in American history and do a kind of documentary or argument about.
And one thing that I think might link together some of the cultures where this is a perennial issue. In Japan, there was this panic about grass eaters, right? Mm-hmm. Like vegetarian men that carry clutches and put on makeup and aren't producing enough sperm or producing enough babies. Xi Jinping had an official campaign against girly men. If a culture has this warrior mentality or this, if the leadership has this vision of itself as stemming from a long line of masculine, vigorous fighters and an anxiety that there might be another war coming on the horizon, that's where you see these panics emerge most intently. Countries like Italy, They have machismo, but it doesn't create the same type of mania, the same type of panic, because it's seen as more of an aesthetic, social development rather than something that's affecting the body politic. And they know that when push comes to shove, most of them are running away anyway. So it's less of a priority to get ready for the next fight. Mm. But the U.S. with that, Americans kind of love war. Americans love the idea of going out in nature and taming the frontier. They hate actually doing it, but they love the idea of it. They love competitive sports. They love male-on-male aggression. And all of these cultural tendencies can lead to that anxiety whenever there's a feeling that it might be diminished.
Right. Just a little bit more clip too.
Continues, we won't simply be weaker than our grandfathers. We won't have grandchildren of our own. Civilizational decline is not inevitable. We don't have to be the spectators of our own defeat. We choose this road, not just for ourselves, but for our children. So we have a responsibility to enter into the arena and make America healthy again. We just need the motivation.
Now, what I find interesting is this very next segment he gets into is basically, I don't know what you can call it besides a argument for public phy-ed in public education, right? Like, that's what he's glorifying here. This guy in California had a really, intense phy-ed that, frankly, I think a lot of kids, I loved phy-ed as growing up, but like, I understand like a lot of other people won't. But I mean, how does this gel with like desire for charter schools and, you know, different requirements yeah. and stuff like that?
Chop, chop, chop. When you get to the cone, push off your outside foot, change directions.
The motivation factor for young men
much better, boys.
Is to have a physical challenge that demands developing mental stability.
Chop, chop, chop. There you go.
And if you don't set that up for our young men, our boys, they won't develop properly.
Ron Jones is an historian, a PE teacher, and the curator of the La Parati Archive, which is a remarkable film collection. The archive gives a glimpse into a country that was and still could be.
You've probably heard that American kids are getting soft. The marshmallow generation, some people call them. Well, these are American kids you're watching. The group of high school boys who just happen to be in the same physical education program. They attend La Sierra High School in Carmichael, California.
La Sierra High School was really, it was the last great PE program in America. And it was put together by Coach Stan LaPrati in the late 50s.
Advancement depends exclusively on performance. The teachers designed it that way, and they say it's a key to the system's success.
These boys strove for excellence. In Greek, they called the word arete. It means striving for excellence. And that's how the program was set up. It was that reaching for something higher.
Every boy has an opportunity in this program to advance on the team.
I mean, I don't know how much more when you see that. La Sierra is a public high school.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. And wasn't Michelle Obama kind of doing this too?
Oh, like with remember, I'm old enough so that I remember when Arnold Schwarzenegger was in the George H.W. Bush White House being the youth fitness czar, yelling at fat kids to do more sit-ups. And you're absolutely right that the obvious conclusion here is phys ed in all public schools, but that doesn't really mesh with the Tucker Carlson program. And especially, and I think part of what gives the game away is look at the demographics of the healthy, young, fit men in both the original video and Tucker's piece on the school. He is the way that he talks about the government as well, that it's been taken over, that it belongs to somebody else. It's not ours. It's not really American, George Soros. And therefore we need to either take it back so that it serves the right people, or we need our parallel fitness academies for white boys to create the foot soldiers for the master race to come. But imagine pitching on, I'd kind of like to get Pascal on Tucker Carlson being like, you're absolutely right. What we need to do is we need to get more sports education into urban public schools and raise a generation of fit, mentally disciplined young black men that can then become leaders and mentors all across the country and reclaim the vigor and strength of masculinity in America. I'm curious as to how many of Tucker's viewers would sign up to that program.
Jihad camps in America's inner cities.
Exactly. BLM Hezbollah camps, right? Actually, I would kind of like to see a scrimmage game of flag football between BLM and Hezbollah. I think that they could both field pretty good teams.
The ideological sports league would be, I think, very interesting.
The white supremacists show up and lose to everybody.
Let's skip a little bit ahead here, but there's a few parts of this I want to make sure we get.
We want to take the standards set by the La Parati program at La Sierra and apply it to the entire country.
Now imagine me like rolling the film and seeing this in the headshot and like no one has seen it before. No one that I knew had ever seen this.
I welcome this opportunity to speak to the people of America about a subject which I believe to be most important, and that is the subject of physical fitness.
JFK, he wanted all schools in America to model after La Sierra. It was so important, and we didn't do it. We've got more and more stadiums with more and more people sitting and less people playing. And most people just see PE as a nuisance and something to cut. And actually, it's getting cut left and right because of the pandemic. They're trying to take elementary kids and leave them in a seat 8 hours a day, trying to make up for the 2 years they lost in the pandemic. And the kids are literally losing their minds. And so what's happened is we have generations of young people now that they don't even know how to walk. Literally, I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah, so I'm not sure about that if Fayed is needed.
I think he might be exaggerating. I think he might be talking figuratively.
I haven't seen that before. But, I mean, look, expand federal funding for public education. There you go. You're welcome. Yeah.
We solved the crisis.
Maybe FDR was murdered because he wanted to expand Fayed, but now we can go back. And what did I say?
FDR.
FDR, right, whatever.
Both of them. Right. Yeah. You think that was natural causes. Oh no. Somebody saw the phys ed plan on his desk and it's like, this guy's gotta go.
It's one of the things too that, like, I know you've heard me say this before, Matt, but it looks like Texas is setting up for their next ledge, you know, which we have very rarely here, which is pretty amazing to think of a state this big has a government that barely meets. And the question is like, okay, decades now of Republican control, like what are they gonna be able to get? And the big thing, obviously, that the right-wing boosters want, like the donors, is charter schools. But it's so hard for the Republicans to get charter schools in Texas because every time it gets brought to the floor of the ledge, they get people from West Texas coming out there like, what's that going to mean for our football team? What's that going to mean for our basketball team? Because, like, and, you know, like, I think that's great, actually. Like, I think it's a wonderful thing for, you know, social programs like public education to be centers of the community.
Absolutely.
And it's just one of those moments where you see that, like, you know, there's a lot of popular support to take care of, you know, to take care of kids and to expand our public education program. And it's the Tucker Carlsons of the world who have been waging a war on these systems for years that they are making cuts. They're cutting art programs and they're cutting PE programs because they're cash strapped. You know, you can't say that like we need to do, you know, focus almost exclusively on STEM in public high schools and then complain that we're not doing enough PE, right?
I think that the right, the whole idea, the concept of universal public education is a left-wing one. And sometimes conservative governments or particular states will buy into it for nationalist reasons. For instance, in Japan and in Germany, public education was seen as a vital military tool, so that by the time you young men were of age to serve, they'd be healthy, they could read and write, they knew how to tell time, you know, they'd make good soldiers. When America, as America is stepping back from the idea that you're going to fight an army with these people, meaning like regular Americans, people who send their kids to public school, or the idea that we need these people to build railroads and machines and work in factories or build rockets, do the NASA space program, things like that, then the right, without those kinds of justifications, without those reasons, just why would you bother educating the poor? All you're going to do is create Democratic voters that want handouts, or another source of trouble in the society. The complaint is always that our kids aren't excelling well enough. They're not the perfect supermen that we hoped. But other people's kids, especially those that belong to groups you don't like, well, it's kind of a feature, not a bug, if they're ignorant, slow, overweight, ugly. Plus, you now have another reason to hate them that doesn't depend entirely on who they are or what they look like. You can hate them for being lazy. You can hate them for being fat. You can hate them for being disgusting little, how did JFK put it, chubby, soft children, and hate their parents for making them that way. And that then you get that feeling of superiority, which justifies the social hierarchy that you're trying to defend. Happy days.
Yeah. So let's move to the Kennedy that's still with us, RFK. As he talks about chemicals, just like the last clip was basically, I don't know how else you read it as other than an endorsement of public education. This is a endorsement of an activist environmental protection agency.
In practice, studying the effects of these chemicals isn't simple. We have safety data on an incredibly small number of the 85,000 plus chemicals now approved for use in commerce. Why? Well, that's due directly to the influence of companies like agricultural behemoth Monsanto.
Monsanto actually had a name for the way that it killed studies, which was called whack-a-mole. And whenever there was a new study that was proposed, they would figure out ways to kill that study. And they had a whole team of people within the federal government whose function it was, from Monsanto's point of view and from their own point of view, to kill those kind of studies. You know, there's something like 85,000 synthetic chemicals, and they're regulated under a number of federal statutes. The way that those statutes were structured is that the chemical is regarded as innocent until it's proven guilty. And I think of the 85,000 chemicals, there are probably fewer than a dozen, maybe two dozen at the most, that have ever been removed.
That thing where he says the chemicals are innocent until proven guilty, that's a matter of law decided by particularly pro-corporate courts, saying unless you specifically delineate X pollutant in legislation, the EPA has no bearing on covering it. So that's a problem you should take up with pretty much every Republican judge put on the court, and most of the Democratic ones, or a lot of the Democrat ones.
And there's also the issue of state capture, which is prevalent in the United States. And the regulatory bodies that are supposed to do things like oversee food safety, the FDA is one of the most significant ones, but so is USDA. And these, the EPA is basically, if you're a corporation that knows it's producing toxic products, what you do is you take over the FDA. You, through the revolving door, through promises of future employment, through lobbying, through bribery if necessary, but why would you? It's riskier than just having that revolving door that puts regulators into cushy jobs at the end of their careers. Mm-hmm. You take the agency over and have it essentially rubber stamping whatever you want to put out. It becomes an office attached to that industrial sector. And other countries don't do that. You get regulation in Europe and places like Canada, elsewhere, where you have civil servants that are going to be at that job forever. They don't have to think about where they're going to go next. You also have fewer political appointees in leadership positions in those agencies. So they're professional regulators, right? The stereotypical bureaucrats that whose answer to everything is no, actually exactly who you want in those regulatory roles. But in the U.S., the regulatory state, which is supposed to be an agency that's strong enough to push back against corporate power in the public interest, is just turned into an adjunct of that corporate interest.
Hmm. Yeah, and that's not quite like the same as saying like someone's controlling the government. Like, it's corporations, right? Like, it's not like some sort of outside group of woke Soroses or something like that. It's corporations.
It's not a conspiracy. It's an HR strategy, right? And it's been very well documented. And the revolving door is visible across sectors. Mm-hmm. So in finance, it's actually particularly egregious, where you have somebody like Tim Geithner, who locked in the Wall Street bailout after 2008, and also guaranteed that homeowners would be screwed so that their foreclosures could foam the runway for the big banks. Of course, he retires and is now in a 7-8 figure per year job at a hedge fund or a private equity shop on Wall Street. And if that's not, you don't have to be George Soros. You don't have to have some malign ideological conspiracy. It's just bribery. It's just corruption, and it's extremely effective.
Absolutely. So yeah, like we said, these obvious solutions aren't really presented. Instead, we take a right turn to bro science.
Nice.
And I mean, I think Orwell made this point about the Nazis calling it Jewish science, where it's like, if you're prefixing the word science, you're not doing science. here's Mike Cernovich, of course, a bro scientist, not an actual scientist, but a bro scientist who has some, interesting scientific.
He did win a Nobel Prize.
Indeed. I mean, I wonder if that's his work on consent. anyway, here is Mike Cernovich and some other bro scientists.
Bro science is proscriptive. Bros treat aging as a condition that should be militated against. And that's due to the belief that your body is something that can be fixed or repaired to some degree.
And through self-experimentation, I cleaned up a lot of skin issues by removing gluten from my diet. And that's just one example, because it doesn't work for me. Another example is the raw egg thing. I'm a faithful raw egg slonker. Thank you to the raw egg nationalists for preaching that gospel to all of us out there.
If the bro scientists have a spiritual leader, it would be a man who calls himself raw egg nationalist. Here's his message.
The enemy today is what I like to call soy globalism. The globalist aim is to destroy nations and local communities, and they do this by isolating communities and sickening them through food, and also through so-called medicine, and all the dreadful chemicals we're exposed to on a daily basis. The globalists want you to be fat, sick, depressed, and isolated, the better to control you and to milk you for as much economic value as they can before they kill you. That's soy globalism in a nutshell. Own nothing, live in the pod, eat the soy. The best response to this is a strong politics of nationalism. The nation is only as strong as the individuals who make it up. And that's where raw eggs come in. Eggs are a superfood packed with protein, fats, vitamins, minerals, and anabolic cholesterol. The absolute opposite of the disgusting rubbish that the globalists want you to eat. Eggs are cheap. Can't patent an egg. By making the individual strong, you make the nation strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing that, again, like, from Jordan Peterson to this video, to, you know, the other side of it, like the kind of the precursor to this, like the hippy dippy movement, right? Mm-hmm. You speak to like an alienation. You speak to economic exploitation. You speak to like an isolation that exists. Very briefly gloss over why that's occurring, and instead of it being, you know, a global system of value extraction or a mode of of property ownership, it's some secret group of people who just want to turn you into some kind of sci-fi, dystopia. And not only that, but then I love so much with these right-wing things, Matt, because we talk about this, like, you know, they don't really offer too much on the other side. They just sort of point, here's a problem. We're the ones who get it. We're the ones who listen to you. They don't really get into as to why it's a problem, what the forces are behind it. And then the answers are always so stupid and simple. From things like clean your room, Jordan Peterson, to eat eggs, which I know they're all about, like, the free-range, factory farmed eggs, but like actually like, you know, eating eggs is very good health advice, generally, right? Our government has been telling people to eat more eggs for a very long time.
The funny thing is, like, but you could call this like raw egg communism and just change the pitch a little bit. Like, what is it? What's with the crowbarring of nationalism into this? Let me just play the rest of this. Cause he's like,
yeah, we just,
I'm raw egg nationalist. I'm an Anon right-wing bodybuilder, and I dispense red pill fitness and health information to the masses.
Like, what is... I haven't looked deeply into raw egg nationalists' other red pill advice, but, like, eating eggs, a whole bunch of eggs, it's not, like, nationalistic.
Well, it... Neither is fitness, wellness, bodybuilding. All of these activities, all of these lifestyles are politically neutral, right? Mm-hmm. And sport was a big deal in the Eastern Bloc. The Soviet Union had famous athletes at the highest level. There were fitness programs, in schools, the very aggressive promotion of sport. If you look at Cuba, people, school children in Cuba, adults, sport is a big part of their lives, and it's supported through public funds and public organizations. There's nothing intrinsically right-wing about fitness or even, you know, men being strong. It's this part of it has to do with the particular touch points of the American culture wars right now around gender, sexuality. And there's a confusion or a deliberate obfuscation of, look, don't rape women. Don't sexually assault people. Don't beat up queer people. Have an open mind and a willingness to accept authority from women or people who aren't large white men stronger than you, which is all sound with, oh, therefore the left wants men to be weak. And that has a very powerful presence in the right-wing political fantasy imagination, but there's nothing intrinsic there that pushes in that direction. Similarly, like, they talk about soy globalism. Where do you think that the protein in your shake comes from, right? Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of benefits that go along with a vegan diet. There's different ways to become strong, but this is focused on invented traditionalism And that whole hearkening back to a happier, stronger, healthier, whiter time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also think it's notable that if you want to appear on Tucker Carlson and talk about a gluten allergy without being made fun of, you do it wearing glasses like this. And you'll be okay. Let's go a little bit, even some more solutions here. The part that made this sort of famous and Tucker sort of used as promotional, but it is ridiculous. And again, there's, as far as I can tell, there's no evidence besides some paper from like the 30s, which when they teach you about how to do research, they try to say like, try to get as close to, the current date as possible. Don't go back like 8 decades. For something.
I've tried at various times to sleep on the floor, but it's a bit too much for me. Cold showers are supposed to have various hormonal effects.
Again, this just sounds like
a road to Wellville bullshit, right?
Yeah, when did you get to
the anti-fap part?
Well, I was going to say, like, I've seen women talk about, like, essential oils. Like, this one's supposed to do this. And, like, you know, my experience, like, it's all silly.
Interesting. There's a kind of schism, actually, on right-wing Twitter about you're either sunning your balls or you're freezing your balls.
My name on Twitter is Benjamin Braddock. I'm a right-wing bro scientist. And yes.
Also, I just say, am I wrong to say it's weird that all these guys are anonymous? Like, stand on your shit. What are you making Tucker hide your identity for?
Yeah, especially if you're going to take a big stance like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you can't go halfway when you're literally showing it to the world. Go. You know, go, son.
Tan my balls. The bro science behind ball tanning is generally that it feels good, so do it. The bro science behind it is based on very real science that's emerging, and that's
no. It's not based on very real. First of all, how do you base something on science that's emerging? Like, that science should have to have emerged before you can base something on it. But that that paper is literally from 1936.
Benefits of red light therapy. You know, our cells respond differently to certain wavelengths of light. And red light, it penetrates much deeper into the body. And the effect of red light is to increase the cell's energy. So there are trials right now to actually treat Parkinson's disease. Why you would want to use red light therapy on your ball?
Do you have Parkinson's disease?
Okay. The cells in your testicles.
Parkinson's disease.
Or what create testosterone, the Leydig cells. So by increasing the cellular health of your testes, you're increasing the function of what they do, and that big part of that is producing testosterone.
And I think I on the science there.
And I think too that all this points out that you have a strong entrepreneurial profit-making element to this entire movement. They aren't trying to mobilize people for a particular policy package. In fact, policy, the problem is bad policies, but the solution is available for three easy payments of
$49.99.
Yeah.
And in some ways, if you think about it, right, like the reason that I didn't like phys ed was that it creates hierarchies of physicality that I was not going to be anywhere near the top of. And it's one thing, nobody gets teased in North America for not doing well enough on a test. But if you are visibly the runtiest boy in a gym class or on a sports team, things might not end well for you, right? That's the way that the hierarchy is structured and enforced can lead to, bullying and abuse. The there's an implicit notion that the stronger boys deserve something from the weaker ones. This MLM style actually kind of is a financial version of that same bullying.
Oh, yeah. That,
you know, hey, pipsqueak, you got to pony up, and maybe one day you'll be as awesome as I am. And if you have any doubts, well, just look at these muscles. Let me flex for a few minutes, and that should be all the proof you need.
Right. And, like, you know, the thing is, like this stuff is super profitable. I mean, it has been funny. I think it's just because it's such a ridiculous story how even people who I know who, like, aren't very much, like, online on social media all know about this Liver King thing.
Yep.
Because he's such a ridiculous character. He's, like, got to eat livers and shit. You know, it was just, like, taking, like, an ungodly amount of steroids to create his body. But, like, you know, that's, like, funny enough of a story that, like, oh, he's exposed as a fraud. But he made, like, a shitload of money off of selling his capsules to people. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, well, you probably can't get good liver at your supermarket anyway. It's probably filled with dangerous chemicals. So I'll just powder some of this stuff up and you can, you know, drink it at home and enjoy all the benefits, which I don't know. I feel like goes against the whole, like, naturopathic or whatever you want to call it ethos of those kind of characters. But I mean, there's a lot of money to be made. I mean, every time I realize how much money Jones made from brain pills or from these things, I keep saying, boy, we got to get in on that shit.
One of the few booming industries in late capital hollowed out, late capitalist hollowed out America is anxiety, right? You have so much free floating self-loathing, fear for the future, that if you can tap into it, you can sell practically everything. And since production is extremely cheap, frequently outsourced to China, the margin that you can demand just for somebody to be able to reassure themselves with a purchase. Plus, what other skills do you have if you're, like, the Liver King?
Exactly. Well, that's the thing, too, is, like, yeah, when they would argue that, like, society has made them, you know, expendable, which, again, doesn't really go for your whole, like, virility argument, you know, that we're creating these supermen, that the only thing I can do is basically be a kind of glorified TV salesman. But, like, you know, the other thing too is I just have to, as somebody who is a nerd in college and study philosophy instead of something practical, the psychoanalysis of this shit is just so good, because it's all about the penis at the end of the day, right? Like, the fact that it comes to, because you get the ball tan and stuff, and then there's the semen retention people, right? It's all about this, like, very fundamental sexual anxiety that, like, presents itself in, well, the problem is something with my penis that I kind of, like, either irradiate it with with tan
red lights,
or, like, never touch it unless it falls off, kind of things. And you see both of those things are very, very prevalent in that movement. And I think, again, not very scientific on my side, but I think it probably does show something about some of the underlying features of this this movement.
We got one final clip here, and this is where Tucker sort of slaps himself on the back for baiting the mainstream media into making fun of them.
Oops. When the authorities stop doing their jobs, citizens have no choice but to fill the gap. No one in Washington seems interested at all in why testosterone levels are dropping. It's a joke to them. Just watch their reaction to the preview of this episode.
I gotta say, coming from a Fox News anchor, that is a refreshing and positive celebration of homoeroticism. Good for you, fellas. Good for you.
Why are they all naked? This doesn't make any sense.
Okay, this trip into Tuckum's dreamscape is absurd. I mean, testicle tanning?
You can't homoerotic it is.
It's a pretty blatant fascist posturing.
So if men want to stay male, they must be fascists and also gay. That's what the media tells you. If you care about your health, if you want to stay fit, you must be a right-wing extremist, because good people are fat and passive.
It
This is a slur that is used to prevent health.
I mean, just a reminder, Tucker literally said the solution to this is raw egg nationalism. So, like, I don't know why he's playing so offended that, like, people are saying you're right wing if you wanted,
Association, so that even basic friendship is now suspect. Masculinity as a result has retreated into pathetic spaces like the man cave.
So if you're a man,
I also just say, like, if David and I are ever wrestling shirtless, I'm not gonna be offended if you call it a little bit homoerotic, like
hot.
Either to do anything other than watch a sports game and get intoxicated and eat wings with women with boobs hanging out, then you can do that. I call it bacon and boobies masculinity. That's the only permissible expression of masculinity. The recent
pick it up with what's his name from the Man Show?
Adam Carolla.
Carolla, yeah, is Carolla on the soy, secretly soy agenda by leaving the only masculine possibility to be boobs and beer masculinity?
Also, it's conservatives that push that. Like, if you see anybody bragging about, like, oh, yeah, I eat beef and I'm a real man and I like football and I drink beer and I'm a Christian, deal with it.
Our friend Nick Adams.
I mean, our friend Nick Adams, the alpha male himself, is like,
yeah, I go to Hooters.
About Hooters every single day.
And remember the Bible.
Yeah. You can't, but there's this demonic symbiosis between Tucker Carlson and the MSNBC left where he's so easy and appealing a target to belittle that. It's content that creates itself, a never-ending supply, but it also guarantees that, Tucker Carlson remains highly visible, and B, he can take on this wounded victim persona, very masculine, by the way, very masculine to be a very alpha, being a wounded
Just like Jordan.
Ted Cruz's pronouns are kiss my ass, you know?
I don't think he realizes how unwieldy that would be, right? Like, Ted Cruz was speaking at the podium, but Kiss My Ass's microphone wouldn't turn on. And so Kiss My Ass had to leave until the equipment was fixed, right? There you go. Like, it's, how does it even work? But, they build each other up, right? Tucker Carlson as a content generator and a punching bag for the liberal left media is a gift that keeps on giving. And similarly, all of those reactions can feed back into this perception of him as an embattled guy pushing against the soy globalist conspiracy. Ultimately, that's where this piece really takes that hard right turn into fascism, where it's constructing the enemy, and that enemy is all of these different groups of elites that somehow include school teachers, but also George Soros, but also Joe Biden, and that are somehow incredibly weak, but also have destroyed the strength of America. That creation of the enemy and the amplification of fear and hatred towards that enemy is an essential part of this project. And here he's really nailing it hard because they're coming for your penis. They're coming for your sperm.
But all right, I'm going to get a little problematic here, but let me work out like a little bit of a theory. Forgive me, Kuba, but you know, in the same way that you were talking about how PE was like a very negative experience for you growing up. And I take your arguments. I think that a lot of this stuff, a lot of these guys, I'd like to see what they were like in high school, right? Because I think a lot of this is one of those things which, like, you're overcompensating later in life because you weren't sort of seen as, like, you know, a specimen of, like, physical fitness or, like, ability. And the second thing, you know, I got two things. When I used to work concrete, right, for my job, and I'll tell you, those guys, like, did embody the kind of idea of masculinity that they start talking about a little bit, the people who build things and construct things. they're not passing this kind of aesthetic physical fitness thing like these other guys, right? Like there's a part of this that is like, is very, very vain in the sense. It's like, it's not particularly about your capabilities, like your ability to produce something or to do something, whether it be something like sports or be something like being able to work and being capable. It's about how do people view me when they see me walk into a room, right? So again, it's like, I find that to be, I know plenty of people who got really into health and fitness like later in life, and I'm happy for them. I've also played pickup basketball and sports with them and have been very unimpressed, right? Like I, as somebody who like, you know, am not in as good shape as I used to be, I don't have that mentality about like saying, I'm going to go and do this just solely for like my own thing. And this is just me talking personally. Like it has to have a goal. And for me, like when I stopped playing sports at a high level, like the interest in that started to wane dramatically. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me about these folks is it's like, we're losing this capability. You know, we're losing our physical fitness. We're losing our strength. We're losing all this kind of stuff, but it's like to do what, right? Like there is no what on the other side, like to be a social media influencer effectively is like basically what this is. Yeah. And it's such a weird, perverse version of masculinity, even using a more traditional definition. Like to me, like a good version of masculinity is being somebody who's like capable. Capable if you need to protect somebody, capable if like the car is broken, capable if you're in the woods or whatever. Like having those kind of skills are a good thing. They're not necessarily only male. I'm just saying like as a kind of idea to like aspire to. And I've never seen that from the masculinity types these days. It's all just like other people are fat and I'm not.
And I think that, and you know, this is kind of some advice that I think would help the disaffected, the troubled young men. What people want from a man, from anybody, is like stable presence, a ability to help, a willingness to help, mm-hmm. and if you can cultivate a particular kind of excellence. It doesn't have to be physical, right? Like you said, building things, even just taking out the trash, doing the chores, washing dishes, cooking, like Anthony Bourdain. There's a figure that I would say exemplifies a very positive form of masculinity, and his excellence was culinary. You have to think, like you said, if I'm making myself stronger, what is it for? Is it because I can do so I could be better at sports? Is it so I could be better at outdoors activities? So I could be better at certain kinds of construction or labor or other activities where that matters? Is it just to be pretty? Maybe. That's fine.
And that's fine too, yeah.
But what's missing in all of these pieces, in all of this Tucker Carlson masculinity crap, is what are you good for now that you've gone through this wellness phase? And I think you're absolutely right that for them, it's largely social. They could very well be compensating in the sense that they miss out on the days when being physically imposing could get you status and recognition and admiration.
Or the other way is like a longing for that time when, mm-hmm. you know, when you're younger and it seems like that matters so much more, yes. than it does later in life, you know? So like, it doesn't, you know, it wouldn't debunk my theory not to, you know,
oh yeah.
And if somebody was a good athlete and they're really worked up about this now.
Yeah. I think that there's different paths to get there, but like you said, it's a little like the guys that wear tactical cargo pants, right? Mm-hmm. It's about projecting an image socially where you're expecting to get the kudos of masculinity, partly because you don't know how else to make yourself excellent. Mm-hmm. You don't know how else to communicate to people that you've got something to offer. And it's much easier to work on yourself narcissistically than figure out, well, what can I do that's worthwhile?
Because you're still at the so like if you go into the process and let's say you're successful, you eat a bunch of eggs and you tan your nuts and you drop from 230 to a nice 170, you're trim, you're fit, you're strong, you're still alienated.
Yep.
You're still isolated. You're still in the same kind of world. And like, I could only imagine that that would also give me a tremendous amount of resentment too. Cause like, it is not easy to take care of yourself physically in the way I think the ideal that they're trying to present there is like to have.
Yeah, because you have to go to fucking work.
Yeah, I mean, like it's a lot of work. It's a lot of discipline, and those are not bad things to promote. I think it's a great, you know, generally a good thing to promote, you know, a level of fitness amongst people. It's a lot of work, but like imagine you go through it. You're like disaffected and you're lonely, and you go through it. You buy the eggs and you do the shit and you lose the weight, and now you're this guy. And then you just are pissed, right? Because like yeah. You did all the shit. Now old society doesn't, you know, have a role for me anymore because they
fucking given women. Up on
men. Yeah, exactly.
Fucking women, fucking and queers and libs.
And you sound the exact same when you go into it as you do on the other side. And I think that's fundamentally the point. Is it's really, it's just like, it's like having kids and you're watching them and they're out of control and you're like, all right, let's just let them run around the room long enough and hopefully they will tire themselves out kind of activity, right? It's like, all right, let's just give some people some kind of goal, you know, that they can chase after. And, you know, hopefully they don't get there because once they get there, they're going to be in the same position as they were once they started.
And when you have these spaces, because they're not just masculine environments, the bro science world.
Yeah, that's very true. I think it's important.
There's a selection bias, right? You know, hashtag not all men, right? We're not bro scientists. I'll speak for myself. I'm not a bro scientist. I'm a bro alchemist. You're self-selecting into a pool of, like you said, possibly insecure, possibly nostalgic, but every one of these guys has got something off. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to improve yourself psychologically or socially or emotionally being around a bunch of pathological personalities. So you might pump yourself up. You might get strong. You might get fit. You might get cut. But you're also going to learn some bad mental habits. Mm-hmm. And then coming out of it, your Tinder profile might get a lot more hits, but you'll be confused as to why.
They don't last.
After three messages, every woman ghosts you.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, and again, like being, you know, having like the experience of seeing like the kind of hippie world, right, which is like similar kind of things. It's the same kind of game in the sense of like you're alienated, work sucks. You're going to try to leave society. I don't have a TV. You know, I don't like listen to pop music and I don't, you know, I only eat organic. That used to be like a much more of a designation than it is now, you know, kind of thing. But you see, so then you do that for 35 years and you're still in the same kind of position. Like all of these things really do harp on this kind of fundamental alienation and isolation. If I could, just because, you know, if we have like torn down the statue of Ball Tanning and Tucker Carlson, replace it with one who I think is a great kind of role model for young folks is somebody like Paul Robeson. You know, Paul Robeson, American communist, he still holds records at Rutgers. He was like one of the most talented running backs of his generation. Becomes a lawyer. People always forget that he was a lawyer, an actor, and a world-renowned singer. You notice like every activity that this person did, if it was intellectual or artistic or physical, dominated. And but what did he do with that? I mean, he used his celebrity. He used his abilities to go and fight for, you know, black liberation in this country. But also like for the entire working class, he was, you know, somebody who was brought in front of HUAC. And if people haven't seen it, I mean, if you want to put some blood in your cheeks, there's reading the lines from what he said. And it's James Earl Jones, playing, Paul Robeson. And, you know, this is somebody who like excelled at every aspect of his life, but never sort of turned his back on like the people and like was fighting, for like the decolonial movements. Was fighting for fair wages in this country, was fighting against Jim Crow. Like that's like a very positive thing, because I do think that, you know, on our side sometimes, there is a kind of hesitation to celebrate, you know, like greatness, right? And I think that that's like, that's a very human thing to want to aspire to be something better. Like, the fact is that the vast majority of us will never come close to, you know, being a person like Paul Robeson, but like, there's nothing wrong in wanting to pursue that. And I think that like, what we're, at least what I'm upset about with these folks is not that they're actually saying you should like work on yourself, you should get better and do all these kind of things. It's that one, like the end result is like sort of just as depressing and continuing the same kind of cycles in the same systems. You know, I think that like being able to celebrate and praise and want to be great and want to encourage greatness in others is like a fundamental left wing, you know, value too. Like, you want to live in a great society. I want to live in that world.
Yeah. And I think that, we should, one, recognize that the left can produce heroes, and great individuals, that, it's not a, it's not a pot of crabs type thing where if somebody does become exceptional and cultivate their excellence and get recognition for that, then we immediately want to tear them down. That is a bit of an instinct in some left circles, unfortunately, but that's something to get over. And I think that with Paul Robeson, because it's a historical figure, there's less risk of that. We can, and he's not the only one. We can find remarkable figures all across the international left, and of course the American left as well. And the second is, you don't have to be a hero to be worthwhile. And you don't have to be Paul Robeson to get a date, right? Like the much more salient is the mentality of like service, helpfulness, solidarity, and a willingness to put yourself forward, to volunteer, to do what's necessary, make things easier for others. If you don't want to fall under the spell of some toxic guru that'll take advantage of that, but most people will respond to that in kind and will want to help you and will recognize the value that comes with being that kind of person, that people want more people like that in their lives. And I think our biggest weakness on the left is we don't have a place for to put the seekers, right? We were geographically spread out. A lot of our institutions are virtual. A lot of our meeting places are chat rooms. And the most significant kind of solidaristic mutual support really has to happen in person. And the DSA is great at auto-cannibalization, and a lot of overtly left places. And we talked about this a little with Matt Crisman on our TRR show, are recreational rather than purposive. So people have less of an investment in what they do with their spare time. They, they're leftists as a type of consumer. But if we can create anything from a chess club to a car club to any functional group where people can learn some skills, help each other out, then that would be very valuable as a place where we can create some relationships, cultivate some solidarity, and practice some of the mentorship. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I'm old enough so that maybe it's time for me to start helping more. And I do what I can in my personal life, but if there were institutions, then I might be able to do more with my time. But where would I go? You know, I'm not going to join the Democratic Party. I'm not going to like sign up for a leftist study group where the only things on the menu are decolonizations and deconstructing masculinity and whiteness. because I'm not a sucker for punishment. But if I could learn how to fix cars or how to build a fire, you know, like why isn't there a leftist Cub Scouts? That's what we need, I guess.
You're quiet.
I think Sam Cedar makes this point. I can't remember which director it is, but like Hitchcock or someone says that for American audiences to get them on the side of a character, you show that character being competent at whatever they're doing. And and I think there's a lot to that. Like somebody competent is somebody that can empower you, basically. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that that's like the one of the social challenges in front of us, trying to build, because I mean, you know, we talk about this on this program a lot. I know we talked to Michael about this. I think it's worthwhile to look and notice that the right wing is trying to pick up people. And, you know, it's important to try to find ways into it. I think that's difficult is finding out where to go, and how to dedicate yourself to those kind of things. But I think it's not something that you should sort of wave your hands around about. There is an issue in the fact that, you know, the fact that these people are so ridiculous and they have influence, I think shows how serious of an underlying problem that there is, if you get what I mean.
Yeah. The demand,
yeah.
For reassurance, guidance, mentorship is massive and growing, and the right wing has an incredible advantage in the resources that they can bring to bear, together with their willingness to ruthlessly extract more from the people that they ensnare. So on a shoestring, without hierarchical organizations with armies of wage slaves to do your bidding, it's hard to compete. And that's one of the challenges that if you want to be the next Paul Robeson on the left, figure that out. Yeah. And it'll be a big step in that direction.
All right, we have a little bit more. We just want to get Rag Nationalist's monologue to end here.
Boobs hanging out, then you can do that. I call it bacon and boobies masculinity. That's the only permissible expression of masculinity. The recent attacks, these are coming regularly now from the regime media, is going to the gym is far-right behavior. Physical culture is far-right behavior.
Well-ordered, disciplined groups of men bound by friendship are dangerous precisely because of what they can do. They can upset the status quo just like that. A few hundred men can conquer an entire empire. So that's why they want you to be sick, depressed, and isolated.
You want to demoralize the people. You want them emasculated. You want them to create no threat to the ruling regime. They haven't thought it through, right?
Increasingly large numbers of men are dropping out and ceasing to be men, ceasing to do the necessary things that men must do. Those kinds of societies obviously become weak and ripe for dissolution. Things are going to get worse before they get better. How much worse isn't exactly clear. But I think we've had intimations over the past couple of years, especially with the 2020 mostly peaceful riots, people are realizing, I think, that they're not where they need to be if they want to survive, if they want to continue to live a fulfilling life, if they want to protect not only themselves, but their families and their friends and their way of life. Once a society collapses, then you're in hard times. Well, iron sharpens iron, as they say, and those hard times inevitably produce men who are tough, men who are resourceful, men who are strong enough to survive. And then they go on to reestablish order, and so the cycle begins again.
Well, what are we worried about then? I mean, if the strong men are coming, inevitably, cyclically, like, I'm just going to eat my cheeseburgers.
And don't you use stone to sharpen iron?
Yeah, that's actually very true.
Iron sharpens iron. Yeah, so wrong on so many levels. And I mean, the whole
It's biblical, the iron sharpens iron thing. So
yeah, of course, you know, between the Bible and thousands of years of metallurgical practice, obviously, I know
there's been some advances.
But the unspoken premise is that unless you're working at scarfing raw eggs, then the hard men that will thrive in the hard times are going to be,
leftists,
black dudes, Muslims, leftists. It's funny too that they treat queer culture as fundamentally opposed to this notion of masculinity that they prop up. Like, have you been to a gay gym? Mm-hmm. You know, like those guys, if there are hard times, those guys are going to be fine. Right. The units, when he talks about, groups of men, strong men bound by friendship can change the world. There's something to that. If you look at, there's a book by Vadim Volkov, Violent Entrepreneurs, about the emergence of organized crime in post-Soviet Russia. And the most successful criminal gangs came out of Afghanistan war veterans associations, soccer clubs, martial arts gyms. It's true. Like, you can get a powerful, small organization of people who are willing to risk themselves, cooperate with one another, face danger, if you tap into this energy. That said, a lot of those groups also got wiped out by other groups. And
the cycle begins again.
Well, it's also, boy, be careful what you wish for, right? Like, because if this is what you're hoping for, the hard times that open up the way to the hard men, well, at this point, like MS-416, whatever the Salvadorian gang is, or I can imagine people harder than Mark Cernovich is, I guess, what I'm saying.
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
Who might, consider aging to be something that you strive valiantly against. Mike Cernovich looks a lot older than he did when he was a headache in our field, as opposed to just doing bro science now and being supposedly apolitical, according to, Zaid Jilani. But anyway, Kuba, where can people follow your work if they want more modeling of masculinity?
I'm on This Is Revolution, usually Thursdays, but there's sometimes, depending on topics, I'll be brought in throughout the week. I appear on Give Them an Argument with Ben Burgess regularly too. January 22nd, if you so desire, you can meet me in person. I'll be with the rest of the TIR team, as well as Left Reckoning, Ben Burgess, special guests at the Cutting Room in New York City. I'm very excited for that live event. And, follow me on Twitter at Dr. Kuba 2.
Thanks, Kuba. And folks, we will see you on Tuesday.